I'm Dave Knutson, and the title of our session tonight is International Human International Human Rights. And our guest tonight is Laverne Riki, whom many of you know already. He's a professor of law at the University of Washington, and especially works in contracts and family law. The reason we've invited him tonight is that he's also had some experience with the problems of human rights on an international scale, both in terms of the Lutheran World Federation and what some of their work has been, what some of their policies are in connection with this problem, and also, more specifically, he's been in Africa and has dealt with some of the questions on human rights in Africa. So Vern is going to say some things to us tonight first, and that'll kick off our discussion. We plan to end about 10 o'clock, unless we're in the midst of a heated discussion, which has happened a couple of times this week on forums. If we are, then we can extend it a little bit beyond that, because there isn't anything scheduled here. But we'll tentatively set a 10 o'clock closing time. Vern?
I'd much rather listen to Dave sing myself. But I guess we'll have to get another occasion for that day. In a way, that was beautiful. 1970, I think it was, I was a representative for the American Lutheran Church to the assembly of the Lutheran World Federation. And had the very good fortune at that time of being elected as a member of the steering committee, or the executive committee, as it's called, of the Lutheran World Federation. Lutheran World Federation, as I'm sure most of you know, represents almost 100 different nations now. That is, the Lutheran churches in about... Tom, did I double-cross you by being here instead of a little bit? I'm sorry. Lutheran churches around the world who are members of the Lutheran World Federation, a very diverse group, as you can imagine. I suppose that there are, 75 or 85 million of us in the world, Lutheran. And LWF is kind of an international body. And since some of our churches come from the Western world, and some from the Eastern world, and some from emerging nations, and so forth, the executive committee, which is truly representative of all of those different cultures, is a fine place to start seeing some of the different notions emerge. After I'd been with the Lutheran Council for a relatively short time, the council asked that someone be selected to go to South Africa, in particular to Southwestern Africa, or Namibia as it's now known, to participate as an observer in trials that were being conducted at that time involving questions of human rights with the black population, of course. I was given an opportunity to be the representative for LWF on that occasion. Later, I made a second trip down to do the same sort of thing in South Africa again, the second time representing not only the Lutheran World Federation, but also Amnesty International, and which is essentially an English-based operation with many branches in the United States, and also another group that probably most of you never heard of, organized by President Kennedy in the United States, called the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights Under Law. And that gave me an opportunity to again observe trials, and also to be with counsel in South Africa. I obviously am not able to represent anybody in South Africa, since I have no standing as a lawyer outside of the state of Washington. if I have any here. But I at least could consult with the people who were representing the persons who were charged of various crimes. Later, I might have gone to South Africa again, but I found out that it's now very difficult for me to get a visa or permit to enter South Africa, and I have a feeling that I'm not one of their favorite people at the moment, and so someone else will be doing that kind of thing for a while. I want to make two observations, and then we can talk about some of the problems that are involved here. One of them is sort of definitional. I wonder what you mean when you say human rights. We have in the United States, I think, a rather different understanding than many places in the world about that. And it may be that each one of us hold our own feeling about what a human right is. For me, when you have a right with reference to me, I have a duty, because they are correlatives. If you have a right to something, then somebody owes you something, someplace. I cannot conceive of a right that doesn't have a correlative duty someplace. So that's what a right is to me. It's not just that it would be nice, but it's something that's owing. And then I wonder what differentiates a human right from other kinds of rights. You know, there are military rights, and then there are constitutional rights, and then there are legal rights, and then somebody started talking about human rights. Well, what's this human rights stuff? Does that mean that it's not a right which is politically assured? You know, there's no legislation that gives it to you. It means that it's not constitutionally assured. There's no constitutional basis on which to claim what is being asserted as a human right. That there is no statutory base, there's no case law basis for it. In short, there just is no legally enforceable mechanism of any sort. You don't have any way of implementing politically or legally or socially the thing that you claim as your right, and therefore you hang this label on it, human. And for those of you who have been around this week, you may have already discovered that I really am one of the world's most confused people about what that means. I started out this week confessing that I don't know what morality means. I have a lot of difficulty with that. And I talk about enforceable rights and non-enforceable rights. And middle ground is something that I just don't comprehend very well. Is a human right that? That middle gray mush in there. Well, I get a little consolation from the Declaration of Independence, where it says that we are endowed by our Creator with certain, the word is, unalienable rights, and that these include life and liberty and the pursuit of happiness. That, to me, is a very important phrase, because it says that God created you with certain characteristics which make you a human being, and that you are not able to dispossess yourself. You can't alienate. You know, the Constitution doesn't say that nobody can take it, the Declaration doesn't say that nobody can take it away from you. It says that you may not alienate them. You may not dispossess yourself of those characteristics and still be a human being. If you do not have life, well, obviously you're not a human being. If you don't have liberty, you are not a human being in the sense of enjoying what a human being is supposed to be able to enjoy. And if you are not able to pursue a rich, meaningful life, then you are short-circuited, so that you are not engaging in life and in participation with other people in the way that a human being is supposed to. Now that, to me, is a human right. And the claim, the duty, is one which I think is uniquely owed by a Christian person to anyone else because a Christian person perhaps uniquely understands what it is to contribute to the welfare of other persons, not because of compulsion. Nobody can make me. It's not something that you can take me to court and sue me. And it's not something that you can compel me to do, but rather because, simply because it is an obligation which I feel toward other persons. And that to me is a human right. When you cross the line over and go into a legal right, then you get into a constitutional setting. And our Constitution in the United States says that no one may deprive you of certain things, life, liberty. Now watch it. The pursuit of happiness never made it. Life, liberty, and property. They had exactly the same experience in France. When they went constitutional after their revolution, when it came to brotherhood, liberty was one thing, equality was fine. Those are presumably legally enforceable concepts. But when it came to brotherhood, people treating other people like human beings, sort of like what we meant with the pursuit of happiness, they threw in the sponge and said property. Exactly the same thing that we did in the United States, for the simple reason that now you are not talking about humanity as much as you are about defensible, legally enforceable obligations that some people owe other people, and you have compulsion. I'm trying to set the pattern between compulsion and kind of a grace as the difference between legal rights and human rights. And you may not agree with me one bit, and that's fine. I'd like to toss that one back and forth with you. Point number two. Does a church have any business at all in getting into this sort of a puzzle? And if so, how in the world do you go about it? The Lutheran World Federation, quite unlike the World Council of Churches, chose an essentially non-militaristic, that's a very badly chosen phrase, it's the best I can come up with right now, a low profile, one of trying to provide people with things like transportation, spaces in which to meet and talk to each other, as well as food and medicine, education, but not with arms, not with equipment for any kind of a revolution in the violent sense. And this, of course, is a difference, perhaps only in degree. And I will illustrate that now by saying that during the time that I was with the Lutheran World Federation, we frequently provided airplane tickets and helped arrange visas for leaders of movements in emerging nations, people who were known to be activists politically. We did not put a gun in their hand, but we made it possible for them to fly someplace and meet with other people who had common interests to discuss the problems that they had in their governments and with their people. I wonder if that's a difference in kind, or is it only a difference in degree, in involvement? Can you, in your minds, differentiate between helping political leaders get together and talk about what they're going to do next year as being permissible, but draw the line at providing them with armament or training which would help them directly in political action which might result or which does result in some kind of violence? The Lutheran World Federation tried to draw such lines and adhered to it rather rigorously, although it did involve things like taking leaders who were politically unacceptable out of their nations and taking them to schools in other nations and educating them there about what problems would be expected at the time that a new government was to be formed, and holding them ready to be flown back to their nation in the event that there was a process underway which would result in a new government. And all of that may sound very revolutionary to you. It at least anticipates the possibility of an overthrow of one government and replacing it with another. Or maybe I'm being entirely too pussyfooted about this whole thing. Maybe you are of the opinion that let's go. We know what's right, and let's have at it. And if that means bloodshed, why, that's the way it's got to be sometimes. That's another possible philosophy. Now, one or two more short sentences, and then I would really welcome your comment. In fact, I will insist upon it, since I don't have anything more to say at the moment. One effort that the LWF was making, and that's how I got directly involved, of course, was to try and utilize legal process, something that could be done fairly well in South Africa. South Africa has a very interesting tradition. On one hand, the power group in South Africa, are a very earnestly religious group. They come out of a strict Dutch puritanical kind of religious experience, and they are earnestly persuaded that they are doing God's will in providing care for people who are inferior and need God's care. When I ask for a permission to go to Namibia, it was necessary for me to get clearance from a person who would be in about the position that our Secretary of State is. It's no small matter. I was really taken by surprise. And he asked me what I intended to do and why I wanted to go. And we finally got to the place where it was quite obvious that our religious understanding was different, as well as our political understandings. And he said to me, "Mr. Riki, I come to my work, to my office, 45 minutes to an hour early each morning, and I spend that time on my knees asking God that He will direct me so that I can better serve the needs of the people that He has put into my care. And do you say that I am not a religious or a Christian person?" That's a very difficult position to be in. I wonder what your answer would have been. Perhaps I should tell you what mine was. The other side of that coin was that the first time I went down, I did what a lawyer always does at the last moment, and that is to try to read some legal authority. So as I was on the airplane riding to South Africa, I was reading the Constitution of South Africa. And I came to Article 6, and Article 6 of their Constitution says that no court shall question the validity of any enactment of the Parliament. And I felt like walking up front and telling the pilot to let me off at the next stop. Why am I going here? And I learned after I got down there that, as with many other processes, even though you cannot deny the validity of what the Parliament has done in legislation, you can construe the thunder out of it. And do what the Hebrew call pilpul, that is, interpreted so that west now means east, and make it equitable rather than literal. And I watched judges do it while I was in South Africa. So there are these possibilities that the church can try to utilize political avenues if it is willing to play what you might call a lawyer's game, that is, political or legal corner cutting. Can you think of any other nasty expressions as to what lawyers do? If the church ought to be in that process, or the church can finance and support direct revolutionary action in the sense of violence, or the church can cut its pattern as narrowly as the LWF did. I wonder how you feel about some of these things. Or maybe you want to cross-examine me first as a way of getting started.
Vern, you led us on somewhat in your confrontation with the official in South Africa. Would you give us your response to him?
Yes. My response was that I simply did not understand a Christian's position in the world as he did. And I saw myself as a Christian as a person who had an obligation to free and to liberate another person and let that person become as self-determining as possible. And he asked me the obvious question, politically, you mean? And I said, as rapidly as possible. In the meantime, with as much dignity and as much freedom of action as is possible, even though it's inconvenient and even inexpedient for the government. I believe that we are endowed by our Creator with certain unalienable rights if we are human beings, and among these are life and liberty and the pursuit of happiness. That's got an awfully American ring to it, especially in South Africa, and the difference becomes not totally, but largely one of perception of Christianity. You know, to the South African, the black is inferior by the creative act of God, and it is the responsibility of the white as the superior one who has been placed in dominion to make determinations as to what the black shall do. Dominion here means exercising hierarchical control. For those of you who speak Shramese, that's John Shramese, or Yoderese, you know that dominion can be read as domus, lord, the servant. And the role of Christianity then is to be the husbandman, the caretaker of, but not the dictator to, the person who is being served. And those are very different approaches. I gave him a little bit of Yoder, and Yoder's not a big seller in South Africa.
Your point concerning your confrontation with him seems to hinge over his sincerity in the matter of his faith.
Yeah.
C.S. Lewis, and among others, has pointed out that sincerity is one thing, and intellectual honesty and theological honesty is quite another. One can sincerely believe something and be quite wrong. For instance, there's no doubt in my mind whatever that Hitler was quite sincere about killing Jews, but it's another thing to say that he was honest in doing it.
I don't believe that I could fault this gentleman in terms of honesty. That brings me down to your third choice, and that is he was wrong. And that carries some embarrassments with it, because now I'm making some judgments, but maybe that's what I have to do. I mean, maybe that's what we must do, you know, in deciding whether or not we rightly understand our relationship to God. And if so, protest and say, brother, with all love and respect, you're wrong.
What do these other countries, or how do they take a stand when you are using our Declaration of Independence, which is strictly an American framework, and try to take that to their country and equate it?
Very effectively, really, by saying that, well, you know, your experience has not been so red hot yourself. Tell me about the Indians. Or how are you doing with your black population these days? And things like that. And asking whether or not we think that we have a superior culture and civilization to theirs. That can get a bit embarrassing once in a while. That's the typical kind of response that I've heard in a way.
I would think at that point that the difference would be that at least one has a constitution within which the struggle takes place. You've got a recourse there in this country, for example, for those who finally take the lead in calling the country's attention to its own drawbacks here. Whereas in what you're describing in South Africa, you don't have the constitution to to have recourse to. So you have to start at a different point.
You do indeed. The South African doesn't have that avenue which we use, maybe abuse and overuse, but the South African doesn't have, I mean the black population, simply doesn't have access to that kind of an argument. So then, Dave, as I'm sure you're way ahead of me on this one, the question is, well, what does he use? Or do you, as a member of the population, simply buckle under and say, well, that's it, I've had it, and give up?
Well, it's my understanding that in most of these emerging countries, or the countries where there's the liberation armies or civil wars going on, that the rebels are often composed of various groups of various causes, anywhere from very communistic, totalitarian type of people to very freedom-loving people. And how does a group like either the World Council or the Lutheran World Federation decide which groups it is going to support and which ones it's too dangerous to support or not dangerous, but they wouldn't be helping the end result? In other words, if we're going to be giving support, I would assume that it would be giving support towards a body or a group that there was some hope, if they took power, would end up in a better result, more freedom, more liberty. And it seems to me that most of those situations are very confusing at best as to what the end results are going to be if rebel group A wins or is given support.
Lutheran World Federation has, I can't speak for the World Council of Churches, I've never been closely enough associated with that group to know. Lutheran World Federation has a couple guidelines or criteria here. In some kinds of cases, the low profile of LWF becomes absolutely critical. And just plain aid, food, blankets, medicine, that kind of thing, is delivered with not a whisper of identification to the Lutheran World Federation. Many of your dollars have been distributed in Asia, for example, under Muslim insignia. And the recipient thinks that that aid came from a Muslim person rather than from a Christian person. The criteria there is the person hungry? And that's thought to be reason enough and justification enough to do that kind of thing. Now, the low profile there is necessary because the country in which the aid is being provided would not permit anyone else to appear and alleviate human suffering. Any whisper or any hint of trying to identify with another culture or anything which would suggest political action of any sort would preclude access totally. And you might now wrestle with that question for yourself. Is that what we ought to be doing, or should we be saying, unless we get to try and open some doors and windows, we don't spend our money? Another criteria, and that is, if we are going to do more than simply provide alleviation of suffering, Namibia is a splendid example. Namibia happens to be predominantly not only Christian in the black population, but Lutheran. Most of those black folks running around out there are our brethren. The Lutheran missions went to Namibia about the same time as they came to the United States. My grandfather had a choice of either the United States or Namibia. I might have grown up to be a thoroughgoing Boer rather than a Boer. And then I decided to go the other way. So there's a population which is Lutheran, and we share with them a conviction in Christ And because of that bond, LWF thinks that it can communicate with those people, and there is a brotherhood, Christian brotherhood there, and it's a beautiful thing. I have never seen people with so much compassion as those folks who are being persecuted. They are worried about us as much or more than we are worried about them. We have a great deal to learn about Christian patience and understanding. Their letters to their government not only ask for alleviation of their own suffering, but when they come from Namibia, at least from that group with which we work, they also have genuine concern for the government itself and the people who are in it. It's a very moving and humbling experience to work with those folks. Well, given that kind of a population, LWF felt that it was wise and, may I say, safe, if safety is a good quality, that it was permissible to provide them with money and blankets and food and medicine, because it would not be diverted into abusive use. In other words, it wouldn't simply be taken out and spent on M31s or something, but it would be used in a way that most of us would feel is appropriate. If indeed we have any common sense, if we have any shared feeling about what appropriate political action for a Christian person is.
I'd like to ask if LWF, as you know, has had any involvement in the Arab Israeli situation in relation to the refugees or those within Israel.
Yes.
Does the same thing apply?
Yes. Start out again with the low profile. The Lutheran World Federation has the management of a physical facility in Jerusalem itself. Somebody here will remember its name. I'm getting old enough, so I don't remember it. But it's the old hospital built by the Germans, time of the First World War, and nobody else would take care of it and maintain the physical property LWF did. That became a meeting place in which unpublicized meetings of the two sides to that conflict were frequently held. Space was provided, a neutral atmosphere was made possible, and the Lutheran Church in that sense became a mediating influence where I didn't have to go to your office and you didn't have to come to mine. We could meet in a middle, safe place. Yep, it did indeed do that, and also there was also the provision of supplies, just things to people who needed them. Maybe I should say a little bit more about that latter, although sometimes my tongue sort of sticks to the top of my mouth because I don't know when I start alienating good Lutheran brethren at this point. When you give resources to somebody else and say this is a gift without strings, you use it the way that you think it ought to be used, you get some wonderful results. You have spent some of your money to provide costs for many abortions in India, for example, at the time of the internal conflict in India, where Indian soldiers from one side raped countless numbers of Indian women on the other, and many difficult pregnancies resulted, and those people elected to terminate those pregnancies. You provided a lot of that care. I don't know whether you wanted to or not. I don't think anybody asked you about it. Maybe nobody ever told you about it before. But it is part of what happens when a body says, we are going to provide resources to people for them to use as they believe it ought to be used. And there are other comparable kinds of illustrations where expenditures are made and the determination what to do with them. Another illustration, which is perhaps more fun, the Aboriginal culture in Australia does not drink very well. they are a total consumption population because they have never had homes and so forth. When they get something to eat, they eat it all. When they get something to drink, they drink it all. And there's been a terrible problem with anybody who gets a bottle of whiskey because they drink it all. And then they start reducing each other in size and stature. And so the Lutheran Church decided to teach those folks how to drink like civilized people. Had it ever occurred to you that part of your offering was being used to teach some Aboriginals how to handle liquor? That meant that they had to come to the church basements and drink like good folks and eat sandwiches and stop and not get drunk and beat each other. That's part of Lutheran World Federation action. Maybe what I'm doing is alienating all the Lutheran World Federation supporters. The message that I'm trying to leave is that the LWF is committed to the idea that people have to be informed but free. Not coerced. Because they are human beings. And if you coerce, you are destroying the thing that you're trying to preserve.
There's another side to Lutheran World Federation. Why do you always keep dark sides of things?
I think that's a lovely side.
Thin and be uncomfortable. Like when there's an emergency and the Lutheran World Federation has the network to get an engineer from Sweden and somebody else from Ethiopia and somebody else from France and fly them to an emergency place and get drinking water for somebody in 24 hours. Seems to me that that's another way that the money's used that people don't know about. And it's a low profile. They never don't care about it.
In the great famine in the northern portion of Africa a couple of years ago, it was wonderful to watch. LWS has a competence to respond to disaster almost anywhere in the globe within hours. It's wonderful, it really is. In that instance, in which people were dying primarily from the lack of water, as Jane has just indicated, the LWR in the United States, Lutheran World Relief, had about $50,000 that it could scrape together. And the Swedes and SAS had an airplane that could go to West Germany and pick up the parts for a pump to be taken to Ethiopia and delivered at the place where the water was most desperately needed in the wells. And your bucks went from New York to pumping water in about a day. It's not at all infrequent for Lutheran World to be on the scene of a major earthquake or a disaster before anybody else. When Italy was badly shaken by an earthquake a while ago, all of those brothers in Christ, the good Catholics, were helped first by Lutherans.
Is the Lutheran Church represented in the world churches?
Yes.
There
are Lutheran constituents in the World Council of Churches, yes. Not all, by any means, but yes. And that's another question, you see, that must be faced by us, and that is participation in any group means that sometimes you lose the vote. And the other side's got more votes than you have. And then comes the question as to whether or not you say, all right, then I'll take my bat and my ball and go home and not play anymore. Or whether you stay with the group and say that inasmuch as we all are trying conscientiously to work out the best solution here, we've discussed this openly. A decision has been made by the group. I think you're wrong, but I'll stay and we'll talk some more. After we've accomplished this action, well, we'll go on. Maybe next time I'll persuade you. Lutheran World Federation is the dumbest organization in the world. It's got to be. All the money comes from one group and all the political clout comes from another. And anybody knows that you can't survive with that kind of an arrangement. I mean, that's politically, well, it won't fly. and therefore it should have disbanded years ago. Seems to be getting along all right. But that's only because we have this rather close feeling of confidence with each other. You're a Lutheran, you must be all right. and I trust your integrity. I may think that you're cuckoo in your judgment, but at least I share this common purpose of grace with you. And therefore, I can go along. The president of the Lutheran World Federation taught me an awfully good lesson once. It was the first or second session that I was in the executive committee meeting. I had my wind up about what was going on in South Africa, and I wanted the executive committee to adopt a resolution which was a good kind of U.S. hit them in the kisser kind of a resolution, you know, trot them all over and tell them what bad guys they are. And I moved for the adoption of this resolution, and the president would not put it to a vote. And I kept pressing for a vote and getting hotter all the time, using all of the good Roberts rules of order, techniques that I could think of to demand a vote. Later, he told me that we were using the Finnish parliamentary rules, which only he knew. And that if he had to, he'd make up some more. Finally, when it got hot enough, he called a recess and he took me aside and said, "Now, Mr. Rieke, this is not being run as a political body would be run. And if I were to put that vote, you would, of course, lose." And I said, "Yeah, I didn't care whether I lost or not. I simply wanted to make my record, have the statement made." And he said, "Mr. Rieke, don't you realize that at least half of our delegates are from nations where if they were to vote in support of your resolution, they would be in difficulty when they went home. And if they don't vote with you on that resolution, they're going to be in difficulty with their conscience. And as it says in the book of Proverbs, twisting your nose too hard just brings forth blood." And that was very persuasive reasoning to me. It finally got through, as Erling Wold would say, both of my brain cells began to function at that point. Of course, he was quite right. It's the whole technique of an international body of this sort to have the good sense and the grace to work at a pace which is possible, trying to implement what you firmly believe without becoming really dysfunctional.
Could you comment on the ALC's request now that the board of trustees divest themselves of funds, businesses that are corporations are doing business in South Africa? Because that gets this whole human rights issue and what's the best way to affect what goes on in another country?
Yeah, I think that's a very good illustration of the kind of problem that one gets. It seems to me that you start out by saying there is not a correct answer to that problem. Either one has very serious negative implications as well as positive implications. Therefore, I could find myself ardently supporting either side of that argument without having a bad conscience about it. Since there is not, in my opinion, a clearly right and a clearly wrong answer, it becomes a question of using one's judgment as to which one has more, which is the least damaging and the most helpful. Viewed that way, it becomes a question where I do not find it necessary to dislike anyone who disagrees with me, because I can see an awful lot of validity to the opposite argument, okay?
Having gone that far, I then sit down and consult my conscience and both of my brain cells in terms of my own Christian convictions about this as closely as I can, and throw in such information as I am able to get about the probable consequences of that kind of an action. And I personally come up with the idea that we ought to call our support out as quickly as possible. In other words, I would favor what the church has asked the trustees to do directing our interests. I don't think it's going to crush South Africa by any means, but I do think that symbolically it has value, probably more value than harm. But if you, as I've indicated, it's certainly not a kind of question that I'd go to the wall about, which isn't that clear to me. How do you feel about it?
Well, I have the same kind of view in terms of the right or wrong question I've gone back and forth. I would end up saying something like you have, in the sense that the symbolism of the action that's taken may say more than our keeping our funds there and attempting to do something through our votes and those corporations, which is really means nothing in terms of any kind of thought. But for me, it comes down to the symbolism of the action that we're taking. And in that case, I think the symbolism says, well, again, the apartheid is still down there, and this is the best way that we can demonstrate that.
Mm-hmm.
The corporation people that I talk to in the comments out there say that that's wrong.
Well, if you ask me my opinion as a lawyer, it's clearly wrong. We are asking our trustees to do something which is extraordinarily difficult and probably violates the trustees' duties to the pension fund and such things as that. So-called prudent man rule for investment and so forth.
And that apparently is some of the objection of the trustees, to do take that serious duty.
Well, absolutely. If I were a trustee, I would sweat large drops at this point. Some pastor who does not receive the pension that he had every reason in the world to expect to get, and which it is my legal duty to protect. And I pull money out from a reasonably good investment and put it in a lesser investment, and thereby put in peril the pension fund and other funds of the church. I am now violating my responsibility, and I wish that I were not a trustee of the American Lutheran Church, which I am not. Don't misunderstand me, but if I were in that position, I would be sweating very large drops. Even though the church told me to do this, still I'm the fellow who possibly collects the heat, ultimately. And as a lawyer, I would say don't do it. It sounds a little bit like Cuba and the Mikado, but as a member of the church, I'd say do it. So, stand to do it.
Part of that ambiguity, I take it, is that if you're an investment counselor, you're going to say to your clients, the best way to invest is not to have any kind of emotional or moral attachment to your investment. Right?
Right.
You know, you want to make this as rational
right.
a calculation as possible.
Maximize profits and all that good
sure.
stuff.
Sure.
Security.
But if we take that, of course, then we're right back in no problem of separating the two kingdoms. We're going to find Cleaver, you know.
We are indeed. Very difficult. So you start that thread and you pull on it, and then you find out that it's a very long thread indeed. And it gets to things like should the church divorce itself from security of invested funds and worldly protection? You know, shall we dump all of our money and put it into missions and trust God when He says that more funds will be made available at the time we need it for attention? That's easy for me to say since I get my pension from the state of Washington, which is probably in not much worse condition than the American Lutheran Church. I'm not going to do anything so rash as divest what few good investments it has. You know, in short, my pension's not going to come from the ALC. And so that's a cheap talk from me to talk about trusting God's grace for your pension. Well, the American Lutheran Church is not only a communion of saints, which I firmly believe it to be, as the church in the spiritual sense, it also is a corporation. By grace, not of God, but by grace of the state of Minnesota, I believe it is. And as a corporation, a political body, if it wants to play that game, it plays by legal or political rules. And sometimes you're caught in the middle of those two. As Dave has just said, that's law and gospel and the tension between the two all over again. And it is an uncomfortable position to be in every once in a while. My brother describes it as getting between the bear and the garbage can. That's a terrible answer to you, but I trust you understand what I mean by it.
No one would pick up that question that you raised earlier about the LWF policy of supporting people who are political agitators, at least to a certain degree. And you raised the question whether that's different in kind or different in degree.
Mm-hmm.
One of the questions I think would like to throw out is that,
on the one hand, we seem to appreciate our own constitution in a great way. On the other hand, how did we get that constitution?
We went through a revolution in order to attain it.
Yeah.
And so I'm wondering, in a sense, why we have become so conservative in relation to the events which brought about our own constitution.
Probably because we've become prosperous, don't you think, Dave?
Mm-hmm.
Prosperity has an awful good way of making oneself conservative or reactionary person. If you don't have anything to lose, why, of course, it's easy to be liberal. It may be that simple. And also, don't lose sight of the fact that we have a written constitution doesn't really mean much. England has had constitutional law for a long time, and they don't have a single word written for a constitution. Their courts go to work and make constitutional decisions with no document at all to interpret. Their judges sit on the wool's back and stare at the clouds and then announce that something is constitutional or it's not, sort of taking the pulse of the society in which they live. And they're doing a pretty good job of it. Maybe it wasn't necessary to have a revolution to get the process of testing the constitutionality of things. Maybe that's not dependent upon the document. In fact, maybe we would be better off if we were to throw the document away and commit ourselves to constitutional behavior. Sometimes those words only get in the way. We will now have a 3-hour lecture in 1 minute on basic constitutional understanding. The Constitution is directed at the most fundamental, not at minutia, but at the most fundamental kind of philosophy in a nation. It is the minimum, not the particulars. Because it goes to broad overarching principles, precedent is not important. The rule for interpreting constitutional matters is that the Constitution is new and fresh and uninterpreted every morning. Precedent is very important in the smaller matters of life, whether or not the traffic meter operates on Sundays and holidays. It's very important that you know that, because you're going to be guiding your daily behavior, whether or not you put the dime in the slot or not. Most of us are not that directly impacted by constitutional determinations until they're translated into statutes or ordinances and principles that get down to affect our daily life. Therefore, it might be better off to let the Supreme Court have freedom to feel the pulse of the nation and determine when the next move has to be made in terms of our relationship to each other. Maybe the written document. I could probably get thrown out of law school for this. Maybe the written document is an impediment to, rather than an assistance to, good constitutional behavior. That is a resource that the church has, because while we do have a written document around which we build our faith and from which we understand the revelation, Jesus Christ, because it is our record of the revelation, Jesus Christ. Jesus Christ, to me, is the revelation. The written document that I can hold in my hands is information about the revelation. Maybe I could get thrown out of the American Lutheran Church for that. That then becomes parallel in my thinking to sort of constitutional operation. It's quite unlike statutory interpretation, which would be like the liturgy and the other implementing steps that a church takes. The church then has maximum flexibility in trying to understand the ongoing revelation which we find in our Lord, and try and understand what it is that we do. We do theology, which is not an academic exercise, but is a way of making the Lordship of Christ real in our collective lives. And that freedom, that liberation, makes it possible to do what Martin Luther talked about, as he realized that God did not intend for him, Martin Luther, to withdraw from life and go down into a cell and alternately flog himself and freeze himself, being careful not to involve in human events because he would make errors and therefore do what Luther at that point saw as committing sins, violations of law, for which he would be punished unless he could get those black marks covered up with green stamps. And when you're in the process of trying to cover black marks with green stamps, and you got more black marks than you got green stamps, you don't like God after a while. And Luther didn't. And then one day it occurred to him that his salvation, that is, his reconciliation to God and to man, was not dependent upon the black mark green stamp business, but was dependent simply upon his willingness to believe God's covenant that God would be gracious despite the inadequate performance of Martin Luther. And then he came with that dicta, which to me is so tremendously significant. God gives me the grace, God gives me the boldness to make mistakes in life. The word used was sin. I can sin with boldness, that is, I can go ahead and make mistakes, confident that God's grace is sufficient for my salvation. That is a tremendous statement when you think of it. And that's freeing not only in what you do in your pew or in the pulpit on Sunday morning, but it also is freeing and makes it possible to do whatever you do in your work or your home or your other activities in human life. The Lutheran World Federation tries to operate that way. Yes, sir.
Yesterday, I can't remember, John Sharon was talking about the four different parts of
the time of Christ.
And his being and that.
Yeah.
And I'm just wondering if the church doesn't have the same dilemma as to how it approaches justice in the other worlds, as to whether or not we become the zealot,
Pharisee.
Yes, the Pharisee, or the Essene.
The Essene.
And how do you see that we are approaching that today? Are we the compromiser? Or I'm talking about Lutheran World Federation now as opposed to something else. Are we getting involved in liberation theology? Are we having the same dilemma that the Pope had, I think, when he came under quite a bit of criticism for some of the statements he seemed to tell his people to not get involved in politics, but at the same time came out with some very forceful statements, I think, about that.
Yeah.
He was traveling the same thing that we also
did. I love the picture that John used this morning in his Bible study, where he was likening the church to Noah's Ark. The stink is so bad that if the ocean weren't worse, I'd get out.
Mm-hmm.
it isn't that our church is a perfect vehicle by any means. It's got a lot of problems, as we all know. Yet, it is a better vehicle. You know, it's better than my alternatives. And I am convinced that the Lutheran World Federation is, and the American Lutheran Church, and the Lutheran Church in America, and a theology that stems from what I find in that, and here I sound like I'm saying the Lutherans are better than the Presbyterians or somebody else, and I don't mean that, believe me. But I mean to have a theological construct which is liberating and enabling is so much preferable to not having one. to try and live with law, less, as you and I, most of you know now, I suspect that Mr. Wallstrom is also an attorney. if we had to live only with the poverty of fairness, law, without any equity or without any grace, we would indeed be a bankrupt people. And so this dimension of having a vehicle out here, a structure, a community, a body of people who see grace as being an implementing and enabling force, gives us, in my language, the best I can do with it, is that it's another tool. It's another way of working. Immensely preferable where it can be brought to bear. There are other instances in which I think that it is useful. I do not say immensely, but useful to use the tool which you and I are professionally involved in. It's better than nothing. Law is better than violence. It's better to go to court than it is to slug it out with clubs. Not much, but a little.
More expensive.
and as I was trying to say earlier tonight, and the fact that I repeat myself all the time simply discloses to you that I don't have very many ideas. But this is one that I've got, and that is that our political, social, economic, legal relationship to each other, if organized, is never going to save us. I simply do not believe that if you were to give me all of the resources in the world, including money and law libraries and an unlimited number of aides and assistants and brilliant people to work with me, that I could devise a legal system that would get us out of the predicament that we have been in since the lapse. I just don't believe that every day and every way I'm getting better, and give me enough time and opportunity and I'll save myself from the wrath of a lapsed human structure. I like human beings almost better than anything else, but they have some shortcomings right now. I believe only, finally, that the converting power, conversion, my dear friends, is one of those tough words. I do not mean compulsion. I do not mean coercion. I do not mean bribery. I mean that the love of God ultimately, basically converts the person who is touched by the finger of God so that your entire set of values and understandings are radically changed. Radically. The word is radically. That's like radish, roots. But you are unrooted and placed in another total dimension in thinking about your relationship to God and other human beings. And how is that done? It's done by the fact that I finally come face to face with an entity, Jesus the Lord, the Christ, my Lord, who had no gimmick. There was nothing in it for Christ. No matter whether he persuaded me or not, he was not going to get paid in any way that was meaningful. Not by me, nor by anybody else. And work as I will, I cannot find Jesus' angle. I don't know what the payoff was. and yet I cannot deny that he did what he did. And therefore, finally, reluctantly, screaming and being dragged by the heels, I will concede that he did what he did because he loved me. Now, there's something for you to think about. That almost never happens. I have a relationship with my wife that sometimes almost gets there, if she weren't so limited. Hi, honey. Or are you still there? But you see, that's what I mean by conversion. Finally, you are forced to recognize that this person did what was done, not for a price, but out of really concern for your welfare graciously. Having recognized that, in order to bring your mind into some kind of peace, you have to acknowledge the fact that that was another system operating. That's a conversion. The day that you realize that you are not bound by law and you're not paid for behavior, but you are loved because of what you are, and that your value is immensely high because you are valued that way by the Christ. That's what value means to me. That's a conversion.
Well, then, let me ask, would you say the relation between biblical affirmation of man created in the image of God and the constitutional definition of the purpose of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness?
Yeah. Our founding fathers, in the Declaration of Independence, and whether they knew what they were talking about or not, and whether it was purposeful or not, got off a pretty good one, I think. We were endowed, given, by our Creator. You couldn't get that one through Congress today. We were endowed by our Creator with certain characteristics, right? I think that's what they meant to say. Which constitute a human being. That's what it means to be a human being. This means life and liberty and the freedom to pursue happiness. I think that's a religious statement, a spiritual, a Christian statement, a bit of Christian theology. But when you try to translate that into coercive settings, the sort of thing which you will either do or I'll send the policeman out to get you. Now, as Justice Holmes said, law exists only in the working end of a policeman's nightstick. No enforcement, no law. Now, once you shift from a gracious system without compulsion and no retribution, to a system which is organized precisely around compulsion and retribution. Reward your enemies, reward your friends and punish your enemies. Mr. Kelly today made a good, honest statement about what it means to be a legislator. Now you are in a system in which our Declaration of Independence and our Constitution, to some extent, are either inconsistent with each other or at least hold each other in a very law-gospel tension. I don't know whether I've answered your question or not, but that's about the best I can do.